God is really of creating weapons to counter it. Simply to prohibit, to bar narrow brokers, to bar outsourced contractors from claiming the ETI. Chair, one of our original complaints in the submission made in 2013 on this ETI was around displacement. We are cautiously optimistic in terms of the research done by Treasury and academics forum that the displacement level has been quite minimal. I think it's about 1.5%. So that's better than we had feared, but that is a progress. But I think even if it's a 1.5% share, I think we're wondering what has government done to intervene at 1.5%. Because the ETI Act empowers governments to fine, to ban those companies to defend it, which is placing all the workers, and the government is not why not and so on. Also a point here in chair on the statement is that because of the public service vacancy freeze, it's had a negative impact upon the Department of Labour. They've frozen the labour inspector post, and of course they make it now very difficult for the Department of Labour now to enforce all your labour legislation or good labour. So again, I'll see here in chair to use your powers of frustration and determination to our friends from Treasury to at least displace the Department of Labour to front the labour inspector. Even the one they have a leader now. Sure, Chair. Okay. Thanks, Chair. I think, Chair, two of the questions we have also for Treasury is that how would this ETI relate to the most likely pending national minimum wage, which we hope will come into effect next year? Obviously, some parts will be above the ETI level. What is the long-term plan for Treasury around this beyond 2019? I think, Chair, also to kind of get an understanding of have they considered the impact upon seizing the ETI in 2 years' time? It's obviously been subsidizing. The Treasury said we're quite lost here, about 600,000 jobs created or supported. So what will be the impact upon the economy if we stop in 2 years' time? And I think lastly, Chair, on this point is that on Goldman Sachs, they talked about creating millions of jobs to the ETI. And maybe Treasury can also explain whether it will be the impact of the 20 million rand cap on that. Chair, just in terms of our proposals, we have about 2 proposals. One is in the Act itself. Part 2 deals with people who are not eligible to pay the ETI. So it mentions government departments, local governments, and so on. Our proposal here is to simply to include temporary service providers who are not being eligible or labor brokers. And I think, Chair, also our position would be that for contracts which have been outsourcing from governments and municipalities, they should also not be eligible to pay the ETI. So while we're in there, let's just pick up the chair. We have a one intention program on the Extended Works Program, which often now is a government job and become a source of cheap labor for cashed up municipalities. Chair, other proposal also is to require that the job be obtained from the room to the cabinet and should also be directly employed by the actual host employer, not by a subcontractor. I think, Chair, again, our plea is for government to act upon those companies which are displacing the workers, even if only 1%, as per the existing law, to fill their labor sector post and give them the proper labor. And I think, lastly, Chair, it's about to start to gather more accurate, comprehensive information on the claim. That is one of our most difficult parts, the previous engagement, how to get the right information. So, yeah, I think, Chair, that's basically in a nutshell. I apologize, but we just want to get to the heart of the issue quickly. To get a point across the chair. I think, Mr. Chair, we are ready to engage with consortium to see how we put government to get food, but no one can have government also to hear our members' frustration on the ground. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right, thank you very much. And
the
according to the program, is service. Very good service. Yeah, you can speak on this one. This is the microphone. Thank you. We've got up to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps if I could be allowed to move to operate the projector. Thank you, Honourable Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you for the members of this committee have spent quite some time being seized upon the macroeconomic impacts of ETIs. And we thought that it might be useful for you to understand it a little bit more basically at the fundamentals of its implementation. The service group is an outsourcer. It is an organization that was established in 1998. We consider ourselves the leading integrated facilities management company, providing a range of specialist technical and soft services offerings across various some of those sectors are labor intensive and some are not. We provide opportunities for permanent and meaningful employment in support of over 5,500 customers to which we provide services every day. We employ approximately 60,000 people. These people are not employed as casuals, they're permanent staff within our organization. As an organization, we operate ethically and we participate actively in all industry bodies at senior leadership level in every sector that we participate in. And that includes participation, particularly in our labor intensive divisions, in centralized collective bargaining in those sectors. And we're strong advocates for fair labor practices and compliance across the board. We're 53% owned by the KTH Group. And that changes a little overview of who we are as an organization. We have been involved in the implementation of the ETI since its inception in 2014. And the ETI on the whole has given us renewed focus on the importance investment in South Africa's youth. It's incentivized us to employ more young job seekers who have limited opportunities. We continue even today to provide them with comprehensive training, which has equipped them with the skills required to be fully integrated into the workplace and the broader economy. We support the extension and the continuation of the ETI. We believe that the 20 million rand cap will curtail or limit the ability of firms to keep and create youth employment. And in deciding whether or not we should come and present to this honourable committee today, we thought that we might present our case through an independent piece of research which we commissioned through the University of Pretoria, to better understand for ourselves how the ETI has been implemented in our organization and then to share with you the learnings of that. What we did with this research is we focused it on only three of our divisions, so our three main employment creators, those being our landscaping, security and cleaning divisions. We have seven other divisions within the group that perform a range of other outsourced services that are not as labor intensive as those three, so we directed our research to that. So the highlights of that research, and we've provided the members chair with the detailed findings of that research, but the highlights of that are that since the inception of the ETI, we have employed 14,500 people under the ETI, and those people were permanently employed by us, and of this, a total of 7,900, about 55%, 54-55% of them have been retained in our employ. And I must pause here to say that this for us is quite an achievement, because as a general rule, our industry has relatively high rates of labor turnover. People use us as an entry-level position to gain workplace skills and experience, and to have a retention rate that is as high as it is quite an achievement for us. Briefly, we've submitted claims under the ETI program amounting to about 20 million rand in its first year of operation, about 44 million rand in its second year, and in the year to date, so January to September of this year, we've submitted claims of approximately 32 million rand. I think the key thing here is to understand what that meant for us. So one of the most important factors that we had to overcome in deciding to participate in the ETI is how we were going to get young people into our organization
to be trained and equipped with the correct skills in order to actually functionally deliver on the jobs that they needed to do on the ground. And as a result of that, we've rolled out a number of structured training programs and learnerships throughout these three divisions. And essentially, you'll see from the report, we've spent in 2014 just short of 15 million rand on training the youth that were employed. In 2015, just over 13 million rand. And in 2016, we have, in the 9 months year to date, we have spent nearly 16 million rand on learnerships and other training interventions specifically directed at the youth that were employed under the ECI scheme. We've done that because it has enriched our business and it has created a much more productive environment for us to be able to deliver services to our customers. So, just transposing the stats you've already seen, claims versus actual spend on development, we think that there is quite a bit that we have done in terms of putting back into development opportunities the benefit of the incentive that we received. So, just as a breakdown, of the total people employed under the ETI scheme, 43% of all of those young people coming into our organization have been the beneficiaries of formal learnerships and skill development programs within the organization. In the last 4 or 5 years, Servest as a group has grown significantly. We have, in fact, been fortunate enough to experience double-digit growth in our revenue and also in our employment numbers. And in conjunction with the ETI, we have been able to direct new employment opportunities towards youth. The ETI has provided the supported employees with the opportunity to acquire new job-related skills and experience and opportunities for future development and advancement and promotion. The direct result of this from our research is that the people who have come into our organization have overwhelmingly become better off financially than they were before they joined. And feedback from individual employees under the incentive is that their entire standard of living has been improved as a result of having come into our organization and been employed under the scheme. Being full-time employees, most of them have benefited for the first time of inclusion into formal benefits such as provident funds, life insurance, death and disability cover. These are benefits that these youths have traditionally would not have had access to prior to coming into employment with us. Over 95% of the ETI-supported employees in our organization are black and 34% are female. So to a large extent, the incentive has contributed to the growth of our company, which in turn has led to even more employment of young and inexperienced job seekers. And I must pause here to just make the point that until the implementation of the ETI program and the corresponding training interventions that we put in place, our organization, as a general rule, would have naturally swayed towards employing older workers because they're more experienced. But because we've invested into training, it's allowed us to access a much bigger part of the labor market, and it's allowed us to become a lot more productive. Having said that, I must also just say that we have not displaced any older workers as a result of the implementation of the ETI. What we've expressly done is we've redirected all new jobs that were created as a result of our growth to young people. And as a consequence of that, we've seen a change in the age profile of our workforce, but not in any way that it's been forced through the exclusion of older workers to the benefit of younger ones. We're also very proud of the fact that approximately 300 of these people have actually subsequently been promoted and have attained higher levels of employment within our business. And in fact, what we're starting to see now is an emerging pool of good, solid talent for the future. We've also found that as a result of this program being administered through SARS, that the requirements for compliance with tax and other industry regulations have been quite high. And we think that that will promote a situation where companies such as ours are always compliant with their industry's regulations and with their own tax regulations. So from our perspective, the ETI has enabled us to employ and retain youth and invest in training and skills development. It has also helped our business to grow, and it has allowed us in turn to employ even more people. To this end, our recommendation is that we believe the ETI is achieving its objectives of creating job opportunities for young people, and it so it should be extended. And secondly, that although Treasury have reported mixed results for large businesses, we can safely demonstrate in our own context that as a larger user of the ETI, we have implemented the incentive in a manner that is consistent with its objectives, and that the imposition of a 20 million rand cap would probably curtail our activity around this. So whilst we are in the process of ramping up our investment into the program in the forms of skill development and training, a 20 million rand cap might curtail that going forward into the future. And as a result, our recommendation or our proposal is that the cap should either be removed entirely, alternatively be capped at a much higher rate to allow for greater opportunities for job creation. These options would enable the larger firms that have the capacity to employ and train large numbers of youth to significantly scale up as a result of the incentive. Chair and members, that is the conclusion of my presentation. I would want to add one thing in closing, and that is just to make a very clear distinction between providers of outsourced specialist services and labour brokers. We are very mindful of the issues created in our economy by the advent of labour brokers and the exploitation that that brings for workers, and we are very much opposed to that. We consider ourselves a provider of a very high level of service, of which labour is a component part, and if we were to casualise our workforce, bring in people who were not permanently employed and therefore not committed, we would probably not be able to deliver a service at the level that we would want to as a specialist organisation. And so there should be a very clear distinction drawn between that exploitative practice of labour broking and what we do as a specialist outsourced services provider. Thank you, Chair.
The next is Witzenberg Pals NCC. Where are you?
We sit.
While the gentleman is coming, I just need to alert you to this. Late yesterday, we also got a request from the Solvency Assessment and Management Tax Group who want to speak, right? You are here, are you? And then the Department of Labor, fortunately, here. Just to alert the committee, I notified the three departments concerned. I spoke to one of the DGs twice, and what we have at the moment is just one department. They'll speak at the end. Where's Department of Labor? Ah, yes, you'll speak at the end, okay, when they finish. So let's see how things pan out. We could break after the fourth submission and take questions and then come back to the last few. Let's see how it goes. People are moving faster than we thought, so maybe we take them all together. Good. Let's have you. Thank you. And while we're waiting, may we congratulate Pule Mabe on his honours degree and alert you that he's now doing a master's. And I think he wants to be a vice chancellor, since it's such a nice, easy job these days that he's a career path, and he can manage the very students that he was very much a part of a few days ago.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity to present Witzenberg Pals today. My name is Lennox Plaikis. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Witzenberg Pals, which stands for Partners in AgriLand Solutions. We are a non-profit company that's currently specializing in privately led land reform projects in the Witzenberg area of the Boland. With me also today, Chairperson, I'm joined by my two colleagues, Renette van Staden and Bernadine Verster, who will also be adding any support that might be needed. We have also forwarded, it's basically just one document we will present. Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Without wasting time, Chairperson, the Vatsanduk Pals Initiative has been established in 2012 through an engagement by commercial farmers and emerging black farmers in the Vatsanduk area in agreement to establish black farmers. And this was an agreement between agri-producers, local government, as well as the community of the Vatsanduk area. The main objective being through Pals to expedite land reform in unique ways that can stimulate growth, economic growth, create jobs, and build social harmony within our area. We believe that in this approach is also in line with Chapter 6 of the National Development Plan, which speaks of an inclusive rural economy. The National Development Plan also emphasizes, among others, the development of strategies that would seek to give new entrants access to products and support from better resourced players. Our five key goals as Vatsanduk Pals Chairperson and members of the committee is firstly to establish successful commercial black farmers. Secondly, also to involve the entire community, as I've mentioned, emerging farmers, members of the community, your commercial farmers, the agri and the business sector, into this inclusive process. The objective is also to extend this initiative to other areas in agri-related industries where applicable. We have also established as a key goal, I think as an achievement also, a Vatsanduk one-stop center, which we believe the Vatsanduk center serves as this one-stop shop where various people who would like to participate in land reform initiatives and perhaps projects can access us as a central office stationed in Voortrekker Road in Ceres. Another aim is also to place focus on mentorship and training programs, which is at large today what I'm going to briefly talk about, Chairperson. The PALS mentorship programs that we are referring to is not a formal program or a learnership as envisaged in our gathering today, in line with the Skills Development Act of 1998, but it's a practical guide in our view that facilitates the transfer of skills, leadership, and organizational ability of agri-entrepreneurs, transferring those skills to emerging farmers within our various projects. We view this as a simulated approach where you would have a commercial farmer partnering with his emerging black partner and transferring the relevant skills and expertise that goes with the farming practice. As part of a PALS project, Chairperson, a commercial farmer enters into a mentorship agreement with a black partner. We've also attached to our presentation a copy of a draft mentorship agreement, referred to as Annexure A. The monitoring and implementation of the mentorship agreements are one of the key and paramount things that we as a Vatsanduk Pals are implementing to ensure that all the assistance that's required by the emerging black farmer are provided through the knowledge, expertise, and whatever is already invested in the area of Vatsanduk, which is quite proud, known for its fruit and vegetable farming. Now, coming to the learnership allowance, Chairperson, Section 12H of the Income Tax of 1958-62 provides that an employer may receive a tax deduction for any registered learnership agreement if all the requirements are met in the set section. But for our sake, and for brevity's sake, we'd like to just give a brief summary of the requirements that must be met in order for the employer to qualify for the learnership allowance. As firstly being that the learnership agreement must be entered to or completed during the year of assessment. The learnership agreement must be a registered learnership agreement with a related CETA, we believe. The learnership agreement must have been entered into on or before the 1st of October 2001. That the employer must be the original employer in terms of the learnership agreement, and that this agreement must have been entered to in the course of trade. Now, Section 16 of the Skills Development Act also sets out the criteria for learnership, and it provides that it must consist of a structured learning component, include a structured work experience. It should lead to a qualification which is registered by South African Qualifications Authority, associated with a trade, occupation, or profession. And lastly, that it should be registered with the Director General of the Department of Labor in the prescribed manner. Going further, Section 17 provides that a learnership agreement is an agreement entered into for a specific period of time between a learner an employer or group of employers, and a skills development provider accredited by the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations. Now today, Chairperson, with that background, we understand that being here today as Wittenberg Tales, our mentorship agreement is quite in contrast to the to what is expected in terms of the learnership, because we believe it's unique in its own sort, and it's also an essentially a special relationship between a successful commercial farmer and an emerging black farmer. Now, in this relationship, Chairperson, the commercial farmer takes the emerging black farmer under his wing and forms a mentor-mentee relationship. In this instance, the commercial farmer invests time, financial resources, as well as other resources to expose the emerging black farmer to practices of farming in order to ensure that we assist each other in forming a successful farming business. This approach, in our belief, is done in the most pragmatic manner, so that the black farmer, as an emerging farmer, is taught all the essential skills that are required to manage and administer a farm successfully. With that being said, we must also stress that the PALS mentorship agreements are practical in its nature, and it doesn't prescribe to a formalized approach that you would require, perhaps in a structured learnership, as required by above mentioned legislation. The commercial farmer imparts skills and knowledge that has been acquired over the years in the specific field, and again, your various fruit and vegetables that's currently farmed in our area of the Witzenberg. Accordingly, the commercial farmer they are not accredited by any quality councils for trades and occupations as is currently prescribed in Section 17. Similarly, our PALS mentorship agreements will not necessarily, Chairperson, lead to a qualification which will be registered by SACA or associated with the trade, occupation, or profession. But in our view, we believe that despite it not falling within the category of Section 16 or 17 of the Skills Development Act, the mentorship agreement still brings great value to those who benefit from such an agreement. Not only does the emerging black farmer in this case get taught aspects of financial responsibility and management, but they are also exposed to wealth of knowledge and intellectual capital that has been invested in our area over decades, Chairperson. Also, a second requirement from Section 12 of the Income Tax Act provides that learnership agreements have to be registered with CETA, as previously mentioned, and also in terms of the Skills Development Act. In our view, it does present slightly a problem to Wittenberg Tales, because in our case, the employers that have entered into a learnership agreement with a learner which has not been registered with the CETA is therefore not entitled to claim the learnership allowance, as such agreement does not constitute a registered learnership agreement as defined. Also, Chairperson, that none of the PALS agreements have been registered with any CETA, which means that it will not be considered as a registered learnership agreement in terms of the Act. It ultimately means that PALS will not be able to qualify for the learnership allowance as provided for in Section 12 of the Income Tax. In the Learnership Tax Incentive Review of 2016, Chair, the Economic Tax Analysis Chief Director points out to a number of issues that comes with the requirement of registered learnership agreements. And I remember in the respondents to the survey on CETAs felt that CETAs were a major barrier to the uptake and efficiency of such an incentive. They also felt that CETAs were unable to efficiently assist with the administrative process, and the overall process was too cumbersome in its nature. Now, respondents in that case also suggested that CETAs were unable to fully supply them with the correct information to get learnership agreements registered, which in this case may be because certain CETAs have different requirements for their various registration processes. Now, some CETAs in the sectors of agriculture have, for instance, shown a particularly low take-up of this specific incentive. We are currently representing more than 8,000 farm workers in the Wittenberg area, and there has really been a very slow take-up, Chairperson, with regard to this incentive. Our appeal today, Chair and members of the committee, is some of the objectives behind the learnership tax incentives are, for instance, to promote skills, to encourage human capacity development, to encourage job creation by reducing the cost of hiring and training employees through formally recognized learnerships. We want to highlight that as Witzenberg tells, our mentorship agreements in its current nature fulfills to all the three of the above mentioned objectives. When one considers the duties that are placed on the commercial farmers in your typical PELS mentorship agreement, one can clearly see that the development of skills and human capacity is is the main objective underlying this mentorship agreement. Job creation, economic development, skills development, training and land reform are therefore the key focus in all our PELS mentorship agreements. This is in line, in our view, with the objectives that the legislature seeks to achieve when enacting this learnership tax incentive. Again, Chair, in the learnership tax incentive review, it was yelled that